Hello, and welcome to this Veeam Brown Bag Tech Talk, which will also function as Veeam Community Podcast episode 121. My name is Rick Vanover. I'm Director of Technical Product Marketing and Evangelism at Veeam.
And I'm Clint Wyckoff, who is also a Technical Evangelist
at Veeam Software. So thanks a lot for, A, viewing us via YouTube in the Veeam Brown Bag channel, but also for our Veeam Community Podcast listeners, thanks for joining in as well.
This is an interesting topic, Clint. This is, those of you familiar with Veeam, this, by the way, is the hardest thing we ever have to explain, and that's the notion of leveraged data, which, let's just jump into it. Leveraged data is part of Veeam's bigger vision. We have this notion of the Veeam availability platform, but a lot of people know Veeam for backup and replication, and then they also know Veeam backup and replication for, how old is it now?
10 years?
2006? No, well, the technology, vPower, how old is that?
Oh, version 4, if I'm not mistaken?
Five.
See? Yeah.
So this is actually now almost a six-year-old technology, and we're now introducing this notion of leveraged data. And what I mean by that is really doing some stuff with your storage that you would never have thought possible with a backup. So, when you have to explain, we know about backing up and restoring, but how do you ever explain leveraged data to someone?
Well, it's super important, especially from a conceptual level, because today the folks, IT pros, some of the things that they're challenged with is, testing backups. How do I make sure that whenever failures do occur that I'm able to recover, right? What am I using my secondary disaster recovery site for? Is it just a cold standby location, or am I really truly maximizing that hardware that I've paid for more than just, waiting for something to go bump in the night? So that's really the concept of, leveraged data, making the most out of your investments, not only from a backup perspective, but also from a disaster recovery perspective as well, and using both locations, primary and secondary, to maximize that. And there's a lot of different ways that we can do that, Rick. And one of the most notable ways is through our Storage Alliance partnerships that we have, where we have deep integrations with, the likes of NetApp, as well as Nimble Storage. Where we have the ability to actually power on those storage snapshots in a virtual fenced-off lab environment.
And I would take this leveraged data capability, a couple of different ways. I did mention it's now 6 years old. So the really good profile is from the storage snapshot integration,
right?
Because that's going to be performance on par with production.
Exactly.
So if you have a primary storage system, and it's it's not the official word, but I call it an integrated source. Okay, so that's the currently available Hewlett Packard Enterprise, EMC, yep. A couple of arrays, and NetApp announced Nimble very soon on that one. And then subsequently, a couple of families from IBM.
Correct.
We can read that data, sure, for backups and the recovery technique, but this virtual lab. And the funny thing, Clint, is this is the hardest thing to explain at Veeam. But if you know these storage systems, it's actually pretty easy to do. And I'll throw you a teaser. You can leverage data not just from the storage snapshot. There's right. Also two other experiences. One is the backup file that you can take on any disk.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second would be a replicated VM. And the notion of a replicated VM in the storage snapshot, I like those better because those are primary class of storage.
Well, you're not going to have any type of performance degradation where you made a reference to, using the Veeam backup file.
Right.
It is traditionally backup storage repository target is relatively slower than my production array, right? That's why it's my backup target. So whenever I go to power that on to run it, and what Rick noted before as the vPower technology, instant VM recovery, sure backup, the virtual lab technology that we have, typically there is performance degradation. Whereas if
for backup storage.
Exactly. That's why leveraging those secondary primary storage devices that you have really helps complete the story and make it a much better story to tell, not only from a performance perspective, but also from a usability perspective. What if I wanted to give my developers access to, say, for instance, last evening's SQL backup, right? To make sure that they're coding against the latest set of production data, right? That's very valuable to have at their fingertips.
Yeah, or just, you need to test something that has to be exactly representative of production. And the
right.
only completely representative instance of production is what? Production.
Production.
That's
right.
So if we take a storage snapshot or a backup or a replicated VM from a recent recovery point, you really have the instance of one or more apps in their, you know, the operating systems, everything around those virtual machines available to you. Now, a lot of times people are like, okay, I get this idea. I have a storage snapshot, I'm using it, or I've got a backup, or I've got a replicated VM, and I'm going to use it in this testing capability. But explain to me how it works from the four elements, you know, compute, memory, network, and storage. So let's start with compute. How does it look in terms of compute resources?
Absolutely. So, I mean, if I'm leveraging, you know, hardcore infrastructure that I have at my secondary disaster recovery location, it essentially looks exactly like my vCenter or my Hyper-V environment, right? I'm able to leverage those individual hosts, compute, CPU, memory, to instantly power on those virtual machines and present them to a virtual fenced-off lab environment, as we talked about.
Yeah, so the compute, it's the same host that you're using.
You got it.
Now, the one catch, you said Hyper-V, but for replicas and storage snapshots, that's exclusively a VMware technology for the capabilities we have right now. A lot of things planned, but just to note. The other half of that would be the next. What about the memory resources? Where do those hit?
Well, I mean, the memory, I think it's really important because now I have to make sure that I have enough memory available to power on these virtual machines. I have enough overhead in the environment because, you know, if we look at the scenario where I have production and I have maybe a warm standby location where I'm running some maybe development infrastructure, I might not have the density available to power on these VMs. So what you can actually do is go into the virtual lab environment, the application group, and you can scale back the memory to say 50%. So if it has 4 gigabytes, it's only gonna have 2 in the virtual lab so that you're making sure that you're not gonna steal the resources away from the necessary VMs that are required to run.
Right, so that's really important because, you know, the monster VM is real.
Yep.
And if it has a run state when you're serving thousands or web scale numbers of users, you might need that much memory. The same, you know, all kinds of things, storage performance as well. But in particular to memory, when you run the virtual lab with Veeam, you can indeed pare it down because there's usually only one situation going on. One, like app admin testing,
right.
User acceptance testing for a change, simulating upgrades, those types of things. You know, you could even use the virtual lab to see how the experience would go if you did reduce the memory.
Sure.
You know, you don't know how reduce. I never thought of that, actually. I just thought of that right now. So if you have this monster VM and you're like, oh, I don't know, I can always add more memory, but what would happen if I take away memory, especially if you have a replica or a storage snapshot mechanism, you're going to get a very similar performance experience.
Yeah, but I think the most important thing of everything that we're talking about, leverage data, backup, storage snapshots, disaster recovery locations, it's all about flexibility and having options. And the nice thing about Veeam is the fact that we're able to give you the necessary options. The software is very flexible. It's very forgiving in that regard, that it makes it easy for users to kind of, you know, make changes on the fly, you know, adapt, innovate, and iterate.
Yeah, that's true, but I'll call out that the virtual lab in particular and the application groups, this leverage data part, is honestly, in my opinion, especially for the on-premises private user, this is the hardest part of Veeam backup and replication.
I absolutely 100% agree with you.
Especially when we get to the next topic of networking. But I challenge you, listening and watching, that if you put forth a couple hours playing around with it, that forgiving element, you know, set up another lab environment to test this out, get some knowledge of the virtual lab and the application groups, you're actually going to find that that is a significant mechanism once you have that, okay, I'm good with this.
Right.
Then once you go forward with
probably one of the most underutilized features in Veeam today.
And that's why we took this opportunity with this Veeam Brown Bag / Veeam Community Podcast to kind of explain it. But let's talk about the harder bit, and that's the networking. How, you know, I like to say that
the nasty networking.
It's not that nasty. It's actually kind of brilliant. So specifically, when you think about running data from a storage snapshot, so we've got the compute and memory bit sorted.
Yep.
When we talk about the networking, it's very much in the right to be mortified at the idea that these VMs that were from an hour ago are going to start communicating with everything else, meaning data might, you know, conflict with
production.
Could
potentially get out if it's not carefully routed and fenced off, right?
Yeah.
So the way that Vimal actually attacked that and fixed that problem is we use a Linux virtual appliance trick that we stand up on your virtual switch. It has an interface outside that would allow traffic inbound. So if you wanted to give, say, for instance, developers access to this virtual fenced off lab environment, you could. However, and this is really where the catch is the fact that it uses a separate interface to communicate with those virtual machines inside the virtual lab. And it uses IP masquerading to allow those external connections inside of the virtual lab environment.
So the virtual lab, which from a storage perspective is the next thing we'll get to, is running from the storage snapshot,
exactly,
from the replica or the backup. And inside of that will the production network will be effectively recreated.
Yep.
And it'll exist in the same address space, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Yep. Right. So you can bring up a domain controller, you can bring up DNS, you can bring up an app server, a web server, a SQL server, for instance, and it'll all be able to communicate with each other just if it was on the production network. Unfortunately, or fortunately, it won't be. And it'll be in the lab environment.
And specifically, there are no physical interfaces associated to the virtual switch of the virtual lab. And that's the big bit that matters. The little Linux appliance that Clint mentioned isn't really fancy. It's actually IPCOP. Don't laugh. It boots from a floppy, which has the networking configuration of like what IP address to take here, what IP address to use there. And then the IPCOP is a small image of that Linux instance, so it actually has like no storage requirement, and it's only off when you use it, or it's only on when you use it. Off.
It's only 512 megabytes, if I'm not mistaken.
Very small, and that's basically the swap of the memory when it's on. It's K otherwise, KB size, very small. Anyways, that's only on when the virtual lab is used, and you can fully configure that networking in the wizard, and that is the application group and the virtual lab. The networking is set in the virtual lab of the interface. And let's talk about that last bit, the storage. For both replicas from a backup file and a storage snapshot, what do we do with all these changes in the virtual lab?
Right, so they're actually captured in Delta files. So whenever the virtual lab is torn down, the backup files or the storage snapshots will revert back to the state that they were previously in, or you could actually commit those changes if you'd like to.
The virtual lab, it's real important because you generally, as a test mechanism, you generally want to discard.
Discard, absolutely.
Discard at the end. So it's one of those things that, you know, you don't want to take this mechanism of a virtual lab and keep it as your production.
No. Never meant to have it run for an extended period of time.
It's a test mechanism that's 100% accurate from your production. And the important thing to note is that the storage is discarded and that all of the reads are from either the backup, the replica, or the storage snapshot, and there's no changes to those. Because those restore points from a backup of a replica failover point or storage snapshot schedule or ad hoc, those need to be kept intact, so we're not able to change those.
Sure.
So hopefully that gives you a good sense of how it works. So let's just go back and forth and name a couple of things that you can do kind of in rapid fire. Test windows updates.
Well, I like the use case of auditing. So then I can have, you know, a report that I can provide to my auditor saying, you know, I tested this mission critical application. It's good to go.
I like the idea of testing a very big script that you can't do in production, right? Or not necessarily you can't do, but it might be hard to simulate. So if you have a script, a PowerShell script, or maybe a group policy object that's going to touch a lot of things, like server computer config type stuff, you can test that in there. What other ideas can you think of?
Application upgrades, so giving developers access to, you know, real live lab environments so that they can test to make sure that their code is going to work as expected against the production workloads before they actually go. So I can attach this as proof to a change control that I would go and present to my change advisory board so that they know that things were tested and they're ready to go. And it's going to validate against production before I go ahead and implement it.
Last one I can think of is actually came from a real example. You need to do not just a security scan that says, oh, you're due for that Windows update or that Linux package needs updating, but an actual penetration test from a security perspective. Dare I say this is the every person's cyber range, where you can do tests of like simulating like a SQL Server injection.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that in here and then discard those changes. Right off the top of my head, I mean, these are some very powerful techniques that I like to say you would never expect from a backup product.
Absolutely.
So with that, we are about out of time. We're both at Veeam. You can follow Veeam on Twitter at Veeam, and I'm at Rick Vanover.
And I can be found at Clint Wyckoff.
And thanks for watching this Veeam Brown Bag session. And
as well as Veeam Community Podcast.
Episode number
121. Be sure to check us out, like Rick said, and enjoy VMworld. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching.